Number 83 episodes into WTC, we talk comics. This time we got Mo, that's me, and of course I have with me Brett.
That's right. It's almost like we're back to the beginning, you know?
Yeah. And then there's Chris.
Oh, hey, I got my beer here. Mm-hmm. I'm drinking my beer, and I'm looking forward to talking comics.
That's Chris. And then Keith. How are you doing, Keith?
Well, hey, Mo. It's really good to be here. It's really good to be anywhere, you know. It's great. I'm happy to be around with the three of you gentlemen talking some comics. As you know, I love talking comics, not only on the podcast, but also most definitely on the Twitter, so one might say.
That's all you have to say, Keith?
Well, you know, the next thing I was going to talk about was how much I'd really like to see a Booster Gold topic come up on the show. So if we could get a Booster Gold topic on the show, that would be boosterific.
Okay, the Booster Gold talk has been covered. Obviously, it's just me and Brett here this week, just the two of us. Though you're going to hear both of those other two fine gentlemen this week because they both have interviews they conducted with some very exciting creators, so we're going to throw those in there. And that'll be the majority of the content actually this week, but we will obviously have the Wii views later on and actually some really good stuff there quite a bit. And we're going to open up with, I believe, Brett, what do you say? We share the weekly news with Cup Reporter K, sponsored by the best pop comic book website that's ever been, before ever will be, damn it, Comicosity.
I'm not even 100% sure of what you said there, Mo, but yes.
Just the Comicosity is a good website for comic books, and there's other websites out there for comic books not as good. And they're our sponsor for the news, and we're going to share the news. Does that make sense?
We're going to share the news. We're going to split it down. It's kind of like the...
I'll be Cub Reporter, and you be the K.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Moby News.
The Moby News. Brett Mo. BMO.
BMO, that's BMO. Right.
Team BMO News. This is the weekly news with Team BMO, sponsored by Comicosity. All right, Brett, why don't you open up and give us a news item?
All righty. So anyways, the first news item is coming straight out of Marvel Comics. And also coming straight out of the Age of Ultron. Which I haven't read, but I can still read news, thankfully. So, anyways, Age of Ultron planted the seeds for a new team of Avengers, which is Avengers AI, which is Hank Pym forming a new Automaton Avengers squad, featuring the Vision, Runaway Victor Mancha, a Doombot, and a 616 version of Ultimate Universe fan-favorite character Monica Chang. That one's going to be written by Sam Humphries.
Well, I haven't read Age of Ultron either, but I do suppose I like the cast of characters. So maybe, I mean, I'm sure for the show we'll give the first one a review.
I think it just sounds interesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it just sounds different. So if nothing else, I'll give it that. Different.
Yeah, exactly. I'd agree with that. Okay, well, you got something else? You want me to do one? What do we want to do here?
Let's see now. Why don't you do one?
All right, here we go. Deadpool video game has been released. Video game completely of Deadpool released for the next generation consoles. Has just come out. Reviews on this one are so far in the mixed to lower range. But a lot of people say that if you're a fan of Deadpool, that they're going to love this because it has the perfect personality on it. So... as far as the personality is concerned, that it really apparently nails it. So that's interesting. Deadpool, I don't really think of him as being one of their bigger, more marketable characters. The fact that he's getting his own video game to me is actually kind of interesting. I would not have pegged him for a video game guy ahead of, say, even a character like a Silver Surfer. So that's interesting to me.
Well, some of the comments that I had seen on Twitter today on the few minutes that I was on definitely said they liked the game.
I think for fans, it definitely is probably right up there. If you're not a fan of the character, maybe you won't enjoy it because you'll just be just looking at the gameplay. But if you're looking at the personality, it sounds like they really got it.
All right, I got a piece of news here. It's about Archie Comics. So Archie is going to become the Clod of Thunder. It's a Thor takeoff in Archie. But the thing about it is that it's written by Tom DeFalco, and art is by Walter Simonson.
Hmm. That'll be cool.
You know, I think the thing is that, and I just read an Archie where they basically did a takeoff on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And so I guess what I'm seeing is that Archie's doing a lot of different things right now. I mean, they meet Glee, they meet Kiss, they do all this stuff. There's a lot going on with Archie that you know, I think is really interesting.
Well, I don't know if they ever haven't been. I mean, Archie met Batman at one point. Archie met Punisher at one point even. You know, I mean, I think there's always been part of something that Archie's done. Archie's never really completely out of the pop culture, you know. So, I mean, I think that's cool. I mean, last time I saw Walt Simonson's art, unfortunately, was on a recent issue of The Incredible Hulk, and it was not good, but I think this will be.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah.
Maybe we should even review it.
We're going to.
Woohoo!
Hey, I was even considering pushing for us at one point reviewing Archie Comics Meets Kiss, and then I smacked myself in the head.
That's true.
Got myself straight, and we've luckily saved ourselves that torture.
Yeah.
And that's not based on Archie. That's based on the quality of Kiss comic books out there.
Yeah, pretty much.
I got one here. Armie Hammer apparently has been seen on the set of Captain America 2. And the speculation is that he is going to be Ant-Man. So we'll see if that will be. We'll see if that's correct.
All right. Well, if we're going to talk some movie news, then I got two movie news stories. I'll start with the small one, which is that Mary Jane, the character of Mary Jane, has been cut out of the second Amazing Spider-Man movie, and she won't actually be in it until the third one. And in fact, they're even going to recast the actor who played Mary Jane in it. So,
Okay, interesting. Let's keep on with the news, movie news here. Then, for this time, Zack Snyder apparently has a casting wish for Lex Luthor for Man of Steel 2. He's looking at Mark Strong. I'm not actually familiar with this actor, Brad. Are you?
Yep. Mark Strong was Sinestro in the Green Lantern movie, and he was also in the Fantastic Stardust.
Okay, and just to look at him, he looks like a guy who could be a perfect Lex Luthor.
He's fantastic. He's a great villain. So,
yeah, terrific.
And my last piece of movie news is Robert Downey Jr. will return for the Avengers 2 and 3. I'm sure that everybody in the world knows this by now, but he's not coming back for more Iron Man movies at this point, but he is coming back for the Avengers. So if nothing else, I'm happy with that.
I think that's what people really want more than anything right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I got another one here, then we'll just talk a little bit. If we're going to keep on this, Judge Dredd, the Dredd movie was, unfortunately, the movie that came out was not a success at the box office, and yet fans loved it, and so did critics. And so it's had a really, really strong post-release as far as, you know, pay-per-view and VOD, video on demand, and Blu-ray sales and that type of thing. Strong enough that they're actually considering making a second movie. And since the first one was pretty damn good, I think that's interesting news. I hope it happens.
Yeah, I still haven't seen it, but I do want to.
Yeah, you'll enjoy it, actually. I did see it. I'll lend it to you.
All right.
But it could be your first movie you watch on your new big 60-inch 3D TV in 3D.
Well, actually, I've already watched a 3D movie now.
But you probably did video on demand, not a Blu-ray.
That is true. That is true.
There you go. This will be the even better experience. All right. Got any more here?
Yeah, well, no more movie news, but probably the big DC news of the week is that Greg Pak is taking over Action Comics.
Mm-hmm.
As of November, on issue 25, he'll be joining artist Aaron Cooter.
And from what I understand, some of the news that came out of this is we will see Doomsday. In Pak's run. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about that. I mean, is that should they have held off on Doomsday? He looks, certainly the early renditions, he looks the exact same. Will he be? I think Doomsday was a character who they ruined as time went on in the old 52. There's a chance to reset him. But I would have loved to have seen them hold off for a long, long time with this and really make something out of this after a long, long time. On the other hand, perhaps he's too valuable a villain to have on the sitting on the sidelines. So what do you think about that?
I think for me, it's the question comes down to, like, it's not so much that they shouldn't use him now, but they have to use him right. Like, if they keep using him poorly, as they did, then absolutely, using him right away is going to be bad. Because people still have that memory in their head. Like, I still have that memory in my head of him being a crappy character at the end. I want to get back to the Doomsday that just was used on very special occasions, you know, and just to, like, wow, this guy's hardcore.
Well, that's exactly that. I want a Doomsday that's used on special occasions. I don't want a smart Doomsday. That's not really the point. I guess my issue with this, Brett, is I feel like he should be held back until we're literally sitting there going, when he shows up, maybe they're going to kill him again. And now he's just going to show up and it'll be a brawl. I don't think nobody believes that there's any chance they're going to kill Superman again 25 issues in. The whole point is he's the guy who can kill him. And if he's not going to be there to be able to kill Superman, if that threat isn't there, then the villain to me loses a lot of his luster.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how they do it, but there's no question that Doomsday is a big deal. And so it's not surprising that they're pulling him out.
Yeah. Now, of course, I haven't been reading most of the New 52, very, very little. There was a reference to the fact that he was dead once in the past. Do you know at all if that was Doomsday, if that was something else, if that never actually happened, if that's being retconned? Do you have any idea?
Nope, that will totally be a Cub Reporter K question for next week.
All right, then Cub Reporter K is going to have to be on it and let me know about that, either on the show or on Twitter or through text message or whatever he wants to do. But, yeah, because I'm not sure about that. But absolutely, yeah. Superman's – Doomsday is supposed to kill Superman, not just fight him. All right. You got anything else there?
I got one more piece of news.
Okay.
All right. Our friends at Boom Studios have acquired Arkea. So the Eisner and Harvey winning Arkea Entertainment, to publish Mouse Guard and A Tale of Sand, are merging with Boom Studios.
That's good for, I think that's probably good for both companies. I mean, they've added some high quality books there. And, you know, Boom should be able to continue to get those books like Mouse Guard. I mean, Mouse Guard is one of the best books on the shelf.
Absolutely.
And should be able to really get it out there. Hopefully its visibility even higher. So I think that's very exciting and interesting. I mean, obviously, good for Boom. I mean, I guess they're doing well. And like I say, I mean, I want to see them have continued success.
Well, it says the acquisition makes Boom's catalog the largest independent company-controlled selection of comic books and graphic novels.
I absolutely believe that. All right, I got one last one, considering this is back to movies, and this is only sort of comic book-related. I'm going to try and set it up a little bit more so. The Jurassic Park 4 is coming out. It's said to be smart dinosaurs versus dumb dinosaurs, real dinosaurs. is apparently going to be the plot for this. We're going to have T-Rex and the Velociraptors take on new, unknown, smarter dinosaurs. I'm wondering if they'll be talking smart dinosaurs, where we're going. Is this something out of Turok coming here? Are we going to see him show up on this? What do you think?
It'll be interesting to see who they get to star opposite the smart and stupid dinosaurs. And also the question is Joe Johnston returning to direct?
Oh, it's been several years since. That's the thing. It's been so many years since Jurassic Park 3. I doubt he will be, but who knows? Maybe.
He's one of the only guys that I feel like could control that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think that's crazy. That definitely sounds more like the plot. Getting away from the story, original story, as told by Michael Crichton, and more into, like I say, a comic book world.
So. Oh, yeah, you betcha.
All right, let's move on from the news. You got anything else, or is that the news?
And that is the news.
You do that even better than Keith. Hey, who needs those other two guys? Well, luckily for everybody, we still have a Brett. Why don't you throw out to one of the two big interesting interviews we got this week, or three, actually, because this is a trinity of interviews.
A trinity of interviews. Well, you know, I feel almost like, let's see, perhaps we should throw first to our friend Cub Reporter K, as he takes on Michael Morisi, who writes the book Hoax Hunters, and also Skybreaker.
All right, that sounds good. Let's get to it.
We're here with Michael Morisi, the co-writer, co-creator of Hoax Hunters, writer of Skybreaker from Monkey Brain, and you have a short in the Hoax Hunters Confidential number one, which is out this week from Image Comics as well.
Yeah.
Is Confidential a new ongoing, or is it a special?
No, it's just like a Case Files, actually. Case Files.
Case Files.
You know, it's just a annual. We wanted to, like, name the annual something, and it was kind of fitting, like, as a way to, like, you know, as an archival title to show it's like, you know, these are just kind of things that are, you know, dusted off from their past and things, past missions or whatever opened the door for like the, our collaborators to do whatever they wanted. You know, well, I'll say it's my dog.
Shush.
So
we have a lot of animal guests on the show, almost as many as we have regular guests, either my cat, my co-host's cat, my co-host's dog. There's always some animal appearance. I think it's now like theater. There's it's bad luck if we don't have one.
I'm glad we kept the tradition going. Yeah, I don't know what he heard, but so Case Files is just an annual issue. Hopefully, you know, there'll be Case Files 2 next year with more collaborators. But basically, it was just a way to say, you know, to let it be known that this is something like outside of the regular Hoax Hunters continuity, and it's just something that, you know, so our collaborators knew, we told them, just do whatever you want. You know, you don't have to worry about anything that we're doing or did or anything. Just take the idea of Hoax Hunters and the characters and just do whatever.
So tell the listeners a bit about Hoax Hunters. The book is up to, is issue 10 is out now?
Issue 10, well, it's up to issue 9, but we have the issue 0, so there's 10 issues that's been released. Case Files is the 11th, but, like, number 10 is out September 4th. We had a change in artist. Tristan Jones is taking over, and, you know, he needed a little bit of time to get settled, so we had a little bit of a delay between now and then. Hoax Hunters is... we like to think of it as, we describe it as two ways, either X-Files for the reality TV generation or X-Files meets Mythbusters. And basically, yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. I mean, it's not hard to wrap your mind around, you know, like what Hoax Hunters is. You know, it's a pretty clear, basic premise. So basically the idea is that there's this reality show called Hoax Hunters, and on the show, the team of investigators go out to various parts of the world disproving, you know, folklore, myth, UFOs, monster appearances, things like that. But really those things all exist, and it's their job to, you know, cover them up or deal with them in whatever way necessary.
Now I reread the first couple of issues of Hoax Hunters Zero, and then the first couple, getting to get a feel for it before I talk to you tonight. And I got the Mythbusters thing, I got the new genre of ghost hunting shows where they go into a room and go, ooh, it feels weird. You know, and that's the level of proof that they're offering in those shows.
Right. Oh, it's cold.
That light flickered and it feels cold right here.
Right.
It's like there's someone watching me.
Cool. Yeah.
But the other piece that kind of, and it's this, so what you're doing is an inversion of that, of course, where they really are monsters. And they're pretending that, and they're basically pretending there aren't. One of the things that occurred to me was like Scooby-Doo, if it was never the old caretaker at the amusement park that was behind it.
There's been a number of people who compared it to that, and I love that comparison. I love Scooby-Doo, and I love that like Hoax Hunters is looked on fondly in the sense that like, it is tongue-in-cheek and it is fun, like it is kind of silly, you know, like one of the reviews, you know, there's this one, you know, negative review that'll always stick with me that kind of like broke my heart, that's like, this reviewer was like, you know, this stuff plays off as funny, but I don't think they're trying to be funny. I was like, we are trying to be funny. You know, like, That's exactly what we're doing. We're, you know, part of it's serious and part of it's scary. You know, like when we get into the character stuff, it's generally, you know, we're trying to really tap into what makes these people tick, and that's serious, and sometimes they're scary, but sometimes it is supposed to be funny. Sometimes we are playing stuff up for laughs. You know, we do have a sense of humor, and we don't mind, you know, infusing that into the book. So, yeah, I mean, the Scooby-Doo thing's totally apt, and I love hearing that.
I was rereading. I was quite taken with murder, the character that's introduced in the Zero issue.
Yeah, I mean, I have to give credit. You know, that's all Steve. You know, it's a Steve. That's the character he's had in his mind for quite a long time. He's evolved over the years. You know, from like a noir, something in a noir story to like a manga character that he's working with, and it just never really kind of found a home until we. We're getting Hoax Hunters off the ground, and it's such a unique and iconic thing that he was able to imagine. And I love murder. It's so fun to write him and to deal with him, because it's like, it's just this weird thing that just kind of hangs around, you know? So it presents like challenges, but it's also, it's fun to have him around. It's fun. I mean, he's a fan favorite. People love murder.
I love that image of him, using the video camera.
Oh, yeah.
Next with the giant, the old 60s NASA outfit that he has to wear, of course, for the character. And then him in the swamp with the camera was awesome.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Now the other book you've got happening right now is, Skybreaker. Skybreaker, right. Singular? That's right.
Yeah, Singular. Yeah, exactly.
And, first two issues are available from Monkey Brain. Third issue coming soon, correct?
July 10th is issue 3.
Okay.
Yeah, so 2 weeks from tomorrow.
So, you're doing work right now for, before we get into Skybreaker specifically, the two hottest creator-owned, companies right now. You've got a book at Image and you got a book at Monkey Brain. What are those experiences like?
When you say it like that, I mean, kind of daunting.
It's like I thought about the question.
No.
There's a lot of pressure on you, Michael. Because all eyes of the creator-owned world are on you. No, seriously. Monkey Brain is such a new model for comics. And Image is a model that's been working successfully for 20 years. But now they're in this renaissance this past year. I mean, that Hoax Hunters was part of.
Yeah, I mean, I've been incredibly fortunate, and I don't think a day goes by that I don't acknowledge that, you know, to have given me an opportunity. You know, it took a while to work up to this point, you know, but I've had some good luck along the way, and I'm really grateful. And the experience of like working for both those companies is phenomenal. You know, they both give you, you know, complete creative and editorial control. You know, they let you make your own mistakes and make your own success. And I don't know many other companies that enable that, you know, at least, you know, well, no, there's one that I'm working for now as well that I kind of can't say, but they're also terrific. But, you know, specifically the Monkey Brain and Image, you know, they give you so much freedom, but also give you so much support, and it enables you to tell the story that you want to tell. And, it's great. You know, it's also, I mean, it's a lot of pressure because inherent in being able to make your own failures and make your own successes that you make failure and you make success, you know, it's all up to you. It's on your shoulders. And, you know, that could be daunting. You know, the comic market is tight. You know, there's a lot of good books and a lot of good creators, and it's, you know, in a way you're competing against them. It's a healthy competition, but you know, there's only so many readers and so much money to go around, and you know, you have to kind of fight to survive. And, you know, that can be tough. And, you know, that's the difficult part of it, but it's a good challenge. It's a welcome challenge. And, yeah, I mean, right now I'm just having a blast, you know, writing these books. And I love Hoax Hunters and Skybreaker. And, yeah, I just want to keep doing both and keep doing new things. I mean, creator owned is just, is where I want to be. And, yeah, I'm lucky to be working at all and have people read the stuff that I do.
And is writing a digital first Monkey Brain book, is there anything different that you do in an approach? Is it, you know, it's a few less pages. Is there anything, do you approach it the same as you would like a Hoax Hunters issue, but with, you know, four less pages or however the count is?
Yeah, kind of. You know, Drew Zucker has been is the artist, and he's done such a great job. You know, because I think my mindset is to write towards print. You know, towards that, towards the way that's set up. You know, like everything I've done has been print, and you know, some people who work for Monkey Brain like come out of you know, web comics or stuff like that, or have digital experience to some degree. And I've never really done that. You know, I've never really modified my work to that. And I try, and I think I have to an extent, but I don't know how successful I've been. And I think maybe Drew has had to like make up for a lot of my like, challenges in the script where it's like, dude, this is a small page, man. You know? So he's been really helpful with that. But, I definitely try to keep that in mind. And I have another project coming with Monkey Brain. I can say that. I can't say what it is or when, but I've definitely learned a lot. And the project that I am doing will reflect, you know, I think what I've learned and like being like, okay, this you can do this, but you can't do that. And yeah, I think you know there definitely should be a different approach. But it's not the same thing. It's not. It's just it's not. You know, it's smaller, and it's the reading experience is different. And you have to accommodate for that and be conscious of that. And I need to do that a little bit more than I have. And, I think the later issues of Skybreaker will reflect that too.
Is Skybreaker a finite run? Or a finite run as the case may be?
It's 5 issues total. Drew and I might go back and do some. Our original vision for it is to, we want to do some like Northlander style Western, and have like an anthology of sorts. So we might go back after Skybreaker wraps and do another Western in a few months. I hope to, but it all depends on, you know, what your schedule is like and what Monkey Brain says and how this first series goes over. But that's what I love doing. Northlanders, I think, is one of the best series in recent years, and I would definitely have no problem aping that.
So give the elevator pitch of Skybreaker. What's the it is a Western. Who is Skybreaker?
Man, this is the toughest elevator. You know, like other projects I've had that have like gone nowhere, or you know, hoped somewhere. Like it's such like easy stuff. Skybreaker, it's so hard to be like, it's this, you know. It's just like, you know, it's a Western revenge. You know, that's the best thing I could say, you know. Skybreaker's a guy who is half Native American, half Christian descent. So he's an anomaly for the time in this, you know, frontiers town moving west, you know, sort of like akin to Deadwood. And he you know, in a way sells out his Native American tribe, the Sioux tribe, and is betrayed by his Christian settlement, the people that he had taken up with. And he's a guy out to make himself good again and take revenge on the people who did him wrong. So, you know, it's about the violent roots of American life, and you know, it kind of reflects the violence of our time. You know, I stand by the fact that you cannot kill your way to peace, and that's a lot of what it's about. And it's about like you know, the discourse of division. You know, like, I mean, it's no accident that Skybreaker's, you know, half one thing and half another, and they're conflicting sides. You know, I think that in American politics, we're so drained by that, you know, of like, you know, red state, blue state, Republican, Republican, Democrat, and it's this dichotomy of otherness that we find so hard to reconcile. So it's a lot about that, but at its heart, you know, it's just a violent, bloody revenge like Leone or Peckinpah and things like that, things that I grew up on that I absolutely love. So that was the elevator pitch. That was the longest elevator ride.
You go up it's a tall building kind of pitch.
Yeah, we're on the like,
but still,
200th floor at this point, you know.
The Empire State Building, No, it's great. It's a neat book. It's really engaging. I was just reading it, you know, minutes before I called you up here, and, there's not a lot of, I mean, Western comics is, you know, it used to be, there was a time that it was the genre. I mean, the superheroes were almost wrapped up and it was all Westerns.
Yeah. I mean, I miss that. I wish there, I understand, like, you know, when I had a lot of trepidation, you know, before viewing this, you know, when I showed it to Monkey Brain, I was like, I don't know, you know, it's a Western. And when they accepted it, I was still like, I don't know, And it's a tough sell. I mean, it's a tough sell because it's a dense book, which is not to say, like, I'm not patting myself on the back. It's not, I don't, not to say that dense means good or great or whatever it is. That's for the audience to decide. But, you know, it is a dense book, and it's a Western, and it's black and white. But this is just a book that, you know, Drew and I wanted to make. You know, we love this book, and we love the concept and the what's going on behind it with the story and the characters. So, you know, we know it's a tough sell. It's, you know, it's not like, you know, people in capes beating up each other, you know, which there's nothing wrong with that. But it's just, it's not that, so it makes it hard. But, you know, Westerns have their place too. I mean, you know, there's plenty of cool stuff, you know, Hell on Wheels and Django Unchained, and there's lots of good Western. Well, not lots of good Western. There's a few good Western. There's a few things out there in the Western genre that exist, you know, contemporary, and then they're good, man. They're good. I mean, you can tell great stories in that genre.
Hell on Wheels just shoots, just outside of town here. I live in Calgary. So,
oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so I know a couple of people that have had recurring roles. A good friend of mine is the telegraph operator in the first episode. So
oh, nice.
It's one of those, I know enough people on it that it's actually distracting for me to watch it. Like, hey, it's David. It's, oh, wait, I'm going to have to rewind. I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, it's a good show. It's coming back in, like, in August. I'm pretty excited.
They had to stop shooting here for a couple for a week or two while we recover from
the flooding. Yeah.
Century, okay. Yeah.
Awful. It was so terrible.
So this is usually where I say what's next, and you've already said you can't tell me what's next. You got a Monkey Brain book. You've got another book from a company that supports creator owned, but it is we'll have you back to talk about that one.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, not Image or Monkey Brain. Gosh, other than, yeah. What's next is working on those things, and I have a couple other projects I'm getting off the ground, and, you know, just trying to keep, you know, keep coming up with good ideas and trying to, you know, interact with people who are generous enough to support my work and you know, repay their generosity with, doing the best I can in the stories that I write and the, you know, just make them as good as possible.
Fantastic. Well, we got two books coming up in July from you. We're sorry, one of end of June, one in the middle of July, and then we'll see Hoax Hunters back in September and, hear about the rest soon. So, thanks very much for coming on the show and, look forward to all of that. And, anything you want to plug, anything, how do people find you to tell you how great the work is?
You know, I'm on Twitter, you know, I'm at Michael Morisi. We have the Hoax Hunters website, it's hoaxhunterscomic.blogspot.com. And, you know, the only plug that I have is just that, we're really excited for Hoax Hunters 10. You know, Tristan Jones is taking over, T-Rex Jones is taking over art, and, it's the final arc of, season one. So it's issues 10 to 13, then that's the end of season one, then we'll pick back up with two in the beginning of 2014. But it's, you know, not to take anything away from the early Hoax Hunters, but this is definitely the best Hoax Hunters I've ever written. I'm really, really extremely proud of what's coming out of this, and Tristan's art just makes it sing. I'm so proud of what he's doing. He's a great guy and a great artist, and I can't wait for people to really dig into his work. So yeah, we're extremely excited for that to happen, and you know, it's a good time to jump on board if people haven't been reading it.
And is there a trade out yet of the?
Two. Yeah, there's, volumes one and two are both out, which will catch you up. Well, you'll be caught up until Wednesday's, Case Files releases. And even that's not, you know, again, that's out of continuity. So you won't be lost, if you miss Case Files, because they'll be collected in the third trade.
I love that you talked about continuity for a book, for a one title.
You know. I know, right? I know. It's like so essential. I know. It's
someone somewhere is building a timeline to drop those four or five short stories in around the
you know, it's funny, like there's certain things that as I read it, like as I know the history so well, like people's story is like, no, that doesn't, you know, and I was like, nah, it doesn't matter. And I'm afraid people are coming out like, no way, no, that can't be true. That couldn't have happened. It's like, well, oh well.
Someone at a convention will hassle you that something contradicts, and
I'm sure we've had some things pointed out that I like, had to just scratch my head about and be like, you're right. I didn't know that, but no, you're absolutely right. So, but no, thank you for having me on. Thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Fantastic. We'll talk to you again soon, Michael.
All right. Have a good evening.
All right. Nice stuff. Thank you very much, Keith. And thank you very much to Michael Morishi. I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly. I guess you probably know better than me, Brent. You've had a chance to listen to some of the interview, so.
Yeah, that's what Keith said, so I'm going to take it as the way it is.
Gospel. Yeah, hopefully he asked him. I'm sure he did. So that's good stuff. We really appreciate that. I am looking forward to hearing that one. Brett, do you want to break it up? Do you want to burn a book or just for the hell of it? Or do you want to do another interview? What are we going to do here? Wow. Want to throw some Weeviews out of character? I mean, we don't have a comic book attraction this month because instead Chris was busy with two big interviews, including one I'm really excited to hear, too.
I know. Well, why don't we burn one book each, and then we'll move on to Chris's big interview.
All right, that sounds good to me. Well, all right, we got to burn a book. Here's one that I think is absolutely campfire material, as much as you can possibly imagine. In 1992, there was a television commercial. At the time, Charles Barkley was a big star. He has a television commercial for Nike, I believe it was, and Charles Barkley took on Godzilla in a game of basketball, and it's hilarious in downtown Tokyo. The thing is, while it's a funny commercial and it really stands out and it's a good concept, the idea of actually turning it into a comic book just becomes ridiculous. And yet Dark Horse decided to do that. They published a comic book in December of 93 on this, just a one-shot taking place actually into California, and it's written by Mike Barron, art by Jeff Butler and Keith Akin. I can't tell you how bad an idea this is. If like Superman versus Muhammad Ali, honestly, that's ridiculous too. Like, it's just ridiculous. But at least that's Superman versus Muhammad Ali, and it's kind of unique to its era. This is just a bad comic book. Bad in every way, uninspired, complete cash grab, terrible, terrible book. If you see this book, do yourself a favor and just carry a lighter with you all the time, just in case you run across it at a convention, so you can do everybody a favor and take it right out.
You know, there's no question that that I totally remember that that book.
Well, it's memorable because if you read it, you went to yourself, I can't believe I punished myself this much.
Yeah.
You won't forget it.
I really wish that I had never, ever read that. Yep. That was awful.
That was one of the worst books ever. What do you got here?
Well, back in 1991. Now, there's lots and lots of characters that exist in Marvel. But the truth of the matter is that you know that there's lots of characters that are out there that don't seem to belong anywhere. You know, they're there and somebody thinks that they're a good character, but deep down in their heart, they're not a good character. So there's a character who Marvel has given series upon series to, and it's Deathlok.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Nobody's ever made that character work. That early 90s series was awful. Art, terrible. Oh, man.
And that's where I'm going with this, is the fact that you have a series that ran for 34 issues. Now, don't get me wrong. It started out written by Dwayne McDuffie with art by Cowan. And, you know, that's okay.
It was passable.
It was passable. It wasn't good, but it was passable. But then, as you got deeper into the series, the writer changed to Gregory Wright, who I don't think has ever written anything truly competent. And you've got Kevin Kobasek. This was during that period of Marvel, I think, where they pretty much just were handing out, like, they'd lost all of their good talent to Image. And so they were pretty much handing out to anybody who thought that they could draw. They were handing out.
Well, this is it. DeFalco was in charge at the time, and 280 comic books were being published a month in total or something like that. And I believe like 140 of them were Marvel. So based on that, they were keeping the majority of the market share and trying to keep down Image and DC because they published everything. They published every book, every character. And I'm sure Deathlok had more than one special cover on him. Yeah, in a cover there.
He might have, but you know, he had a lot of story arcs in here. But I am going to burn the Gregory Wright, Kevin Kobasek, Deathlok run.
That sounds good to me. Burn it and don't feel bad about it.
I wouldn't feel bad about burning Deathlok at all. The guy has had like 1, 2, 3, 4 series. Yeah, I mean,
oh my god,
it's just wrong.
Yeah, maybe. Look, everybody, after 4 series, it's just obvious. Nobody wants it. Nobody wants the character. All right, Brett, let's move on to Chris's other big interview. Big interview this week about, what was he, about 40 minutes this one goes?
Actually, this one's 50. It's a little over 50, so he spent close to an hour with him.
All right, well, tell everybody what it is.
All right, well, Chris had the opportunity to sit down with one of his favorite creators, Terry Laban, of course, the gentleman who did Muktuk Wolf's Breath, which I wound up reading during our Secret Santa. So, I mean, hey, I think this is a really exciting interview, and my hat's off to Chris for pulling it off.
Yeah, no, good stuff here. I mean, he talks about working with Fantagraphics. Chris is actually the one who unfortunately breaks the news to him about Kim Thompson, so we don't want to say too much about that, but that's interesting. And I understand from Chris that, of course, Terry Laban worked extensively with all the publishers and has a lot of work with Vertigo. So he has stories, inside stories from all this stuff from a guy who's really been there and done it all.
Earlier this week, I had the pleasure of talking to one of my favorite comic book writers. He's written so much stuff. I fell in love with him in the early Vertigo days. Terry Laban, co-creator of King Features syndicated comic strip Edge City and numerous comic books, including books with Fantagraphics, DC's Vertigo imprint, and Dark Horse Comics. He's here. He agreed to talk to me about his book, Muktuk Wolf's Breath, Hardboiled Shaman, Spirit of Boo, which has been recently added to Comicology Submit. And here's how that interview went. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to We Talk Comics, Terry.
Yes.
First off, can you sort of explain what is Muktuk's Wolf's Breath? Or who is Muktuk's Wolf's Breath?
Muktuk Wolf's Breath is a Siberian shaman who lives sometime around maybe the 16th century, although it's sort of a fantasy tribal Siberian world. He's a shaman, which means that he performs a number of roles in the society. I mean, he's a healer, he's a entertainer in a certain way, and he's also an investigator, and he's also sort of a religious leader, although that's, I haven't really dealt with that aspect. I put Muktuk in the context of, it's sort of a mashup of, I describe it as a mashup of Siberian tribal mythology and classic fiction. The notion being that in the course of Muktuk healing people, which is sort of his basic job, he discovers secrets about them, and it turns into not necessarily a crime investigation, although sometimes crime is involved, but an investigation of things that are hidden. And just as a classic noir detective sort of prowls the nighttime streets and the dirty underbelly of the city, Muktuk prowls the dirty underbelly of his society, which includes a very, large supernatural realm. One of the things a shaman does is go to other realities or other realms of existence in order to find out what's causing the problems that are causing the problems of his patients. Muktuk deals with sort of the supernatural side of existence, but, for him, it's just completely matter of fact. He's not a magician per se. He's not a superhero. For him, in his world, the supernatural elements are every bit as real, as the elements that we would recognize in our day-to-day reality. And the whole thing's sort of done in this, a noir voice, a voice based on classic noir detective fiction, but it only references things that a shaman would know or a 15th century Siberian tribesman would know. So, you know, he won't compare things to, you know, a speeding car or, you know, something like that, a neon sign.
I've always described the book when recommending it, which I have to tell you is not the most easy thing to explain to some comic book readers. I've always described it as Gilton Sheldon's Fabulous Freak Brothers meets Raymond Chandler.
Freak Brothers, really?
I think I get that a little bit from your Cud comics comics.
Well, Cud was sometimes a Gilbert Shelton homage. So.
Now, I am heavily into noir and noir comic books. I'm just kind of curious. Do you have any specific references or not references influence on Muck-Tuck? Any specific sources?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I'm not really a fan of noir fiction or detective fiction. I'm interested in sort of the structure of stories and, you know, I've watched a lot of sort of masterpiece theater detective stuff. You know, but the structure of these things is fairly straightforward and simple. And, you know, anybody who's watched, you know, an episode of Law and Order, you know, sort of knows it. And then beyond that, I mean, the voice, I guess it's just sort of seeped in. I mean, I've never been a huge fan of, you know, Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett. I mean, I've read some of that stuff. But I guess it's just sort of floating around in the ozone. And, you know, maybe that's a good thing because it keeps me from kind of slavishly imitating somebody. Sometimes when you use just your general impressions of things to reconstruct something new, you end up with something a little more individual and more interesting. I'm actually a lot more interested in sort of anthropology and tribal mythology than I am detective stuff. But the insight that I had when I originally created the character was that, you know, the role that is played by a shaman in a lot of these tribal societies is very similar in a lot of ways to the roles played by detectives in classic detective fiction, you know, right down to sort of, you know, the shaman in a lot of these traditional societies, certainly Siberia, is often can be a marginal figure, the way a detective is. And people, while they may need a shaman, sometimes distrust a shaman. I mean, they have the, you know, sort of a reputation of being a little crazy. They deal with things that are unsavory. They go places that a lot of people really wouldn't want to go, although those places might intrigue them. So there's just all these similarities that are really interesting. And when you put this, when you put that sort of exotic, anthropological thing in the context of this very familiar kind of genre fiction, I think you get a real insight into both, and you also make some really fun, entertaining stories.
You're kind of blowing my mind here, because after I read the Vertigo series of Muck-Tuck, Wolf's Breath, I re-examined what I thought hard-boiled fiction was. And it's really affected my reading history for a long time. It's weird how that works. Can you give us a little? Now, what Muck-Tuck's Wolf's Breath has been published in different stories of Muck-Tuck have been published over the years in several different forms. Can you give us a little bit of the publishing history?
Well, it started out, the very first story ran in the first Cud comic, which was the second series I did with Fantagraphics.
Just because this caused some confusion when I was doing some research, that's Cud, not Cud Comics, right?
Yeah, that's a history unto itself.
Yeah. So Cud was at a Fantagraphics.
Yeah.
Cud Comics comes later at
Dark Horse.
And the only reason I really mention it is I find them to be totally different books.
They are, and one of my great career regrets is naming the second series Cud Comics. Dark Horse urged me to do it because I guess they thought I had an actual fan base that would follow me, which kind of turned out not to be the case. And well, maybe it did turn out to be the case, but it wasn't, you know, a vast fan base, and it just caused a lot of confusion. And still does, as you can attest. But they are completely different. But, well, they're completely different books in a lot of ways. They do have a lot of similarities. I mean, They both have kind of an ongoing – they're both sort of based on the 8-ball model, which is based on the Zap model of having a continuing story and then a lot of short things that are in each issue that aren't necessarily repeated. So structurally, they're very similar. And the short pieces that I did in both are also kind of similar. So they do have similarities. The central stories are different. That's the big difference. The first one was a continuing story about a performance artist called Bob. The second one was a series of sort of an Archie ripoff based on the Generation X stuff that was going around at the time called Eno and Plum. But Muktuk was one of those subsidiary stories, and it appeared in the first issue of Cud, the Fantagraphics series in 1992, and it got a lot of acclaim. I mean, people really liked it, and I heard from people saying, oh, this is great, you should do more. So I did another story a few issues later in Cud, and then I went over to Dark Horse thinking I would have a much better situation. That wasn't necessarily the case, but I did do a series with them, as we said, called Cud Comics. So I think I did one more in there, which was a total of three that I did myself. And then in the mid-late 90s, well, really the mid-90s, I started to do a lot of writing for Vertigo. And I really wanted to get a monthly series, and I was shooting all these ideas at them, and I had several creator-owned series. And I thought, well, I'm not probably going to do very much with Muktuk Wolf's Breath on my own. I should try and turn that into a monthly series for DC if I got like an artist and maybe it would be like a big hit. So I pitched the idea to my editor and, you know, Vertigo agreed to do it. So we did a 3-issue miniseries and then they didn't make it a monthly. So that was the story with that. And then I dropped the character for a long time, 14 years. And my life changed. I did A, B, C, and D. And in 2010, a couple things happened. I was in grad school for I got a degree in digital design, so I was doing all this computer stuff. And I got this note out of the blue, an email out of the blue from this guy asking me if the film rights for Muktuk Wolf's Breath were available. Well, it turned out the guy was from worked for Jack Black. And suddenly there was all this potential. And then I also needed a senior thesis project, and I was interested in exploring the whole online comics thing. So I decided to do the online graphic novel, Spirit of Boo, as a master's thesis. And then, you know, if anything happened with the film thing, I'd have something to sell that wasn't sort of a 14-year-old three little stories I did 14 years ago. So that's kind of how it happened. That's kind of how I decided to revive the character. And I'd been getting – you know, messages over the years from people saying, oh, I really liked Muktuk. I'd really like to see more Muktuk. So I knew there was some interest out there. I knew that, you know, I'd have some, you know, instant kind of publicity. If I did it, there'd be some hooks there. I knew it was a good character and there'd be some interest. And I had, you know, I was sort of interested in exploring the character again. All this stuff came out about shamanism after the 90s. The thing is, when I started the story, it was really hard to find any information on Siberian shamanism because all the research had been done 100 years ago, and then the Soviet Union had blocked everything. So it was really hard to get information. That was also before the internet really had shaped up to be what it is now. And of course, in 2010, it's a totally different situation. You know, all this material had come out. There's actually been a revival of shamanism in its historic territory. And the internet, you know, makes things a lot easier as well, obviously. And then there was new books that I'd acquired. So I decided to do that, and I did. And then the film thing ended up not happening, unfortunately. But I have a graphic novel.
Now, I first discovered your work, actually, with the Vertigo series of Muktuk. With Steve Packhouse. But as I've further discovered your work, Cud and like, Cud comic book, Cud comics, once again, screwing me up. I actually had to go back and check if this was the same Terry LeBan. How did your work, because it's not an easy sell, get into the hands of Karen Berger over at DC Vertigo. Had your Grendel Tales already come out?
Oh, yeah. The Grendel Tales thing, that was the first comic writing thing I ever did. And it had come out. I don't know if Karen saw that. You know, I'll tell you, it's a weird story. I was kind of getting known in comic circles through my work with Cud, and a lot of people liked Cud, and I was regarded as a good writer. And I decided at some point around in the mid-90s, I was hanging out with all these professional, you know, comic types in Chicago. We had a big group. And these guys were more mainstream, and I decided to try my hand at professional comic writing. And I used to go to San Diego every year to promote my stuff, and so I'd met a lot of people. And I went to San Diego, and I walked around, and I let it be known that I wanted to write. And I'd known Diana Schutz for a long time. She was the editor of Grendel, and that's kind of how I got that gig. The way I got into Vertigo, I believe it was through Lou Stathis. And Lou Stathis was an editor who tragically died. There he got a brain tumor and died right after a book that I was working with him on. I believe it was in 1996. But Lou had been an editor at High Times, and he wrote me because he liked either Cutter at my first book, Unsupervised Existence. And he wrote me like a fan letter. I guess he followed comics. And so I corresponded with him a little bit. And he ended up working at Vertigo. He was really a sweet guy. And he was interested in doing a creator-owned series with me, which turned out to be The Unseen Hand, which was actually the first thing I sold to them. It was a sort of a conspiracy story about that took place in Russia.
Smartest comic book I've ever read, by the way.
Oh, thank you. It's totally unknown.
One of the questions I had, do you have the rights to this story? Because it's fantastic. If there's a movie made, I want it to be The Unseen Hand.
I never heard from anybody about it.
But I remember I had trouble even getting the last issues of that one. Didn't the sales, I don't think, were spectacular on that.
Well, that's kind of the story of my life, but maybe it was hard, so I don't know. And poor Lou Stathis started to really deteriorate while I did it. Well, we were working on it, and nobody knew what it was. And I was supposed to meet him at San Diego, and I got there, and they were like, yeah, Lou's got a brain tumor. And then he died not long after that. So that was really terrible. But I mean, the comic I'm quite proud of.
It's a great read.
Thank you. But somehow my name must have been around Vertigo, because what happened was that Elisa Quitney, who was the editor of The Sandman, Neil Gaiman was going to quit The Sandman, and they wanted to do this spin-off series called The Dreaming. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yeah.
And they wanted different writers to do the story arc. So, and this is just such a weird story, and I can't believe it happened. But she asked me if I wanted to submit a proposal for the first story arc. And I think it was more or less out of the blue. I don't think I'd ever really met Elisa Quitney. And I was up against several other people, and they chose my story arc, which was Goldie. It was called something about Goldie. I have it somewhere.
I have to say, I thought that was a really weird choice to start with a small little gold dragon. In this very fantasy not fantasy, a fairy tale world rather than the fantasy world that definitely drew a line between what had happened in Sandman and The Dreaming. I really like the story.
Oh, thank you. That may have been their suggestion. I don't remember now, but I think that they wanted a story about Goldie. I don't think it would have occurred to me otherwise. I didn't know Sandman. I'd never read Sandman. So Elisa sent me like all these, you know, paperback volumes of Sandman, and I read through them, and I came up with the story, and they bought it. So that was like this huge thing for me at the time, you know, because, you know, there hadn't been a spinoff of Sandman, and Sandman was this hugely popular thing. And everybody liked the story. So I think at that point, Karen Berger, I kind of had Karen Berger's ear, and my thought was, yeah, I want to get a monthly book and I'll work for DC and everything will be great. Unfortunately, I couldn't sell them a monthly book. I mean, I tried and tried and tried. I just couldn't come up with something that they liked. But I did do several creator-owned series, mostly through my editors. I mean, I did another one with Elisa called Battle Axes, and I did Muktuk Wolf's Breath. And I tried to do superhero stuff too.
Well, I was going to ask, you never really had any superhero stuff published. I always thought it was weird. Usually, I mean, your top tier writers were getting Vertigo. Mm-hmm. And then when sales didn't work, they'd try to gain popularity in the superhero genre before moving back. And you just went over to Dark Horse, but Dark Horse was before.
Yeah, I quit. I dropped out of comics.
Yeah.
You know, the problem for me was and is that, you know, I don't like superheroes. I don't come from superheroes. I come from underground comics and what we now know as graphic novels and that whole artistic branch of comics. And I, even as a kid, I mean, I never had any interest at all in superheroes. I mean, I liked, you know, Little Lulu, and I liked Richie Rich, and I liked Mad Magazine, and I liked Archie. I liked all that stuff. Like, a superhero comic, I mean, I would try to read them, and, I mean, I liked Conan, I liked Sword and Sorcery stuff, but I would try to read superhero stuff, and, I mean, my eyes would just glaze over, I mean, I could not get through it, and when I did get, like, a couple things. I mean, I wrote, this weird Green Lantern story arc called, Green Lantern. It was Green Lantern in an Arabian Nights world.
I'm gonna have to look that one up. Like, I really want to read that now.
Yeah, they were doing a bunch of books at the time, like alternate world superheroes. It was kind of a
Elseworlds.
Yeah, Elseworlds. Thank you. It was an Elseworlds book, and it was like 3 issues or 4 issues. 1,000 Green Nights, it was called, or something like that. It was a beautiful book. It was painted. And I did a Superman story that was never published. and I sold them a series. I'm sure you've never heard of this. This was the most interesting thing. I had this idea for a superhero that would get his powers from heroin.
Oh, there was one character at DC that was a villain that did that. Snowflame.
Okay. Well,
but I don't remember a superhero.
Now, my character was called Junkie Man. And the central notion of the series was, what would happen if a guy who wants to do good gets his powers from something bad? You know? Which I thought was pretty cool. And I sold this to DC. And they did it as a Green Lantern thing. And it went, like, all the way up to the top. I know this because I talked to Paul Levitz about it. And I did the whole script, and they paid me for it, and it was never published.
Oh, I want to read that. That's actually, I like the idea. Junkie Man as a Vertigo comic would have worked, I think, in the day.
Well, that was my thought, but I think it was just too hot for them. They were too worried about it. They wouldn't do it.
Oh, they got a lot of stuff out of Vertigo that I didn't think they would.
I know.
Junkie Man seems tame in comparison.
Yeah, I mean... Now, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. But in the end, you know, even though, like, you'd think that superheroes, I would think, maybe not you, but I would think that superheroes, like, you could do superheroes. What's there to a superhero? It's like, you know, he's got powers, he fights a villain. It kind of was like I couldn't do it. You know, I was like, you know, I'm like the emo guy at the death who wants to be in a death metal band. You know, like, superhero fans know. They know. I mean, the comics industry is all about – everybody in the comics industry now comes from fandom. You know, they're all fans that ended up working in the industry, the editors, the artists, the writers. And if you're not a fan, you're going to stick out. It's not going to work, you know?
Well, that leads right into my next question is we interview a lot of comic book people on the podcast, of course. That's what we're about. And it always generates into what comic books we all like. It always gets into that comic book fan discussion.
Right.
I'm reading, you don't read that many comic books.
I don't. I go through phases. And I have all my old favorites, you know, that influenced me. But I don't make a habit of reading comic books. I mean, I read history, basically. That's what I like to read.
No, no. I'm of the opinion if anyone reads, it's a good thing. You describe cartooning as a way of processing. Mm. Can you elaborate any on that? Or?
Huh, when did I say that?
it was actually on your website.
Oh, really?
You described, described it as an output, not an input, basically.
Yeah, oh, okay, I see what I was saying, unless I, like, just stole it from somebody and had no idea what it meant. yeah, I mean, for me, like, cartooning's how I express myself, but it's not necessarily what I myself consume all the time. It's not what I enjoy. I mean, I do. I mean, I love cartoons. I love comics. I mean, don't get me wrong. And I'll go through phases, like, especially if I go to, like, you know, a comic show or, you know, a Comic-Con or something like that and pick up a bunch of stuff and read it. And, I mean, I've read some great stuff. I mean, there's some great stuff coming out, you know. Like, I read that book, Troop 142, or what is it, about the Boy Scout troop? You familiar with that
one? No, I'm not, actually.
I could go get it and tell you the exact title. Amazing, amazing book. And I've been making my way through Osamu Tezuka's Buddha the last couple of years when I have to, like, sort of get my act together and buy, like, I have to, like, go on Amazon and buy them, you know? you know, I look at, and I, you know, I see stuff almost every week. I see web comics. I mean, I see all kinds of stuff and I take an active interest in cartooning, but I'm not a voracious consumer of comics. I mean, for me, I find stuff interesting and then I express it through cartooning. I mean, that's my, you know, that's the way I sort of put stuff out in the world, is in that form. But, you know, I'm old now and all my influences have sort of, you know, gone in there and mulched. And
thankfully, most of them are still in print. You can find Zap and a lot of it still out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm largely influenced by, I'm influenced by tons and tons of stuff, but a lot of it's fairly well known. I mean, you know, I've got, like, that Russ What's-His-Face's reprint of, you know, the box reprint sets of EC.
Oh, yeah, gorgeous stuff.
Yeah, gorgeous stuff. And that's been, those have been, like, a huge influence. You know, I mean, I'm not a 50s guy, and I didn't read them as a kid, but, you know, you can always go back to that stuff for just all kinds of things. I mean,
you got those while you were working at Gemstone?
No, I never worked at Gemstone. I got them from a guy that used to own a comic book store in Chicago, and he got divorced, and he was selling off all his stuff. And he had all of them. I unfortunately didn't get all of them. Like, I didn't get the Mads, which I was an idiot, and I'm, like, kicking myself for ever since. But I got a lot of them. I got the Vault of Horror and Tales of the Crypt and the Fear and the combat ones.
The ones with no dollar value, but I'd prefer to read.
Really? They don't have dollar value?
Well, not huge, not comparison to the mat.
When I've gone looking for them, they are a lot. I mean, they cost, that's like $300 to get the whole box.
Oh, really?
Each of them.
You know what?
When I've looked, it's been a while since I looked, but, I mean, that's not a huge dollar value, but, you know, and they're not like comic collector stuff, but I'd sure like the rest of them. I was a stupid not to buy them all. But anyways, I do have a fair amount of them, and I mean, you could just, you know, you could just keep going back to that stuff. I mean, you know, and I wrote, you know, you didn't note this, but, cause you probably didn't know, but I wrote Donald Duck comics for 14 years.
Oh, I thought those were published through Gemstone.
No, Gemstone reprinted them. They were actually published, through a company called, Egmont, which is a big Danish company, that has been a Disney licensee for 50 years. And they used to do those they had a bunch of different comics. They'd do weeklies like that were like regular floppy comic books. And then they did monthly digest-sized books that looked like cinder blocks. I mean, they were like 400 pages or something. All new original material. And it was all Donald Duck. And it was all based on Carl Barks. Like and the Gemstone stuff is a reprint of that. That's what the Gemstone stuff is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just because we're talking about this, when you were doing that stuff, did you have any trouble doing anything in there? How was editorial control on those?
Well, it's pretty tight, but the rules are also pretty obvious. I mean, you know, like, you know, you can't have Donald Duck, you know, going to a gay bar and like going to the back room. I mean, you know, I mean, it's pretty obvious, you know, he can't like smoke a doobie and like crash his car into a lamppost. I mean, you know,
comic book I'd read.
Yeah, that's right. Say hi to Disney. I think the Air Pirates did that already. You know, so, you know, in terms of like that, you know, you know that you can't do stuff like that. It's very similar to sort of a family strip. But that being said, you know, as somebody who loves like classic humor comics and who really was, you know, that's the stuff I really come from. For me, it was a great job. I mean, they're very classic stories. I mean, they're structured in a very like, you know, classic way, and the characters are, you know, Egmont kind of prided itself on doing emotionally complex stories with interesting characters. And you could do a lot of, you know, I would often do plots sort of, you know, dealing with the issues of the day, you know, like Donald could be on Facebook. I mean, Facebook wasn't around so much back then, but, you know, I stopped doing it in 2009. But, you know, Donald could go on Facebook and something could happen, or, you know, you could do stuff like that. It didn't have to take place in like the 1950s necessarily. So, but yeah, I mean, editorial control is pretty tight, and, you know, you had to sell them every story. I used to get assigned a certain amount of pages a quarter, but, you would actually have to sell them the stories, and sometimes they would reject them, and, it could be, they could be hard. it wasn't easy, but, for a while I was like a pretty, you know, a pretty big writer. I mean, I did a lot of work for them. I used to write 100 pages of Duck a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've gone back and read a lot of Carl Barks, and I mean, I couldn't even imagine trying to compare my stuff to his. It's just,
well, it's,
the bar is set so high.
Yeah, but they've got a whole industry over there, and you know,
yeah,
they're not doing Carl Barks. I mean, it's based on Carl Barks, but you know,
yeah,
you don't have to, you know. And anyways, hey, you know, I'm getting a page rate, so, you know, I'm worried about, you know, so, I mean, being as good as Carl Barks is kind of the last thing I'm worried about. I want them to buy my freaking story so I can get paid, you know. If I did that, it was like a victory. Because it was a great job. I mean, they paid really well. I mean, I got almost $200 a page, so.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, let's bring it back to Muck-Tuck a little bit here, the new incarnation.
Yes.
Spirit of Boo. Now it's formatted differently or formatted for digital reading.
Yes.
But this was done several years ago. It's only been now imported over to Comicsology. It's been available on your site for quite a while.
Yeah.
I'm kind of wondering if you've seen some of the new innovations with what Mark Waid is doing in digital comic books, what Marvel has incorporated, they're calling it Infinite Comics, where they're experimenting with adjusting your reading pace and like that, where they have different pages with a balloon will pop up when you flip the page.
Huh.
So
yeah, I haven't seen that.
Oh,
no.
Just because the way you formatted your book, I thought – maybe, and I know you're interested in this because I believe you have a degree in
I haven't seen it, but I want to check it out. I mean, you know, I mean, Muck-Tuck's pretty much done, but if I do something else, it's, you know, something I'd like to take into account. I mean, you know, the thing about the digital stuff is it just changes all the time. I mean, I attempted when I did Muck-Tuck digitally, I attempted to figure it all out for myself, and it was really hard, cause you've got to publish, or at least a year or so ago, you had to publish in like 3 different platforms, and like, I didn't like the way it turned out in a bunch of platforms, and it didn't look like, you know, I eventually ended up just putting up a PDF, because that's what looked best on the iPod or iPad. But the Comicsology book is obviously a different thing. So I actually haven't really seen it. I should download it and see what the heck it looks like. But yeah, I'll check out Mark Waid because I'm really intrigued. I mean, obviously, you know, comics reading is going to be, you know, digital, at least on a casual basis you know, more and more from now on, although I don't think the print books will ever be completely replaced, but, you know, that's the way it is.
Mark Waid's title is Insufferable.
Mm.
And the Infinite Comics, which there's a lot of free ones out there. There's the Guardians of the Galaxy series that's offered in Comicology, just for your info.
Oh, cool. I'll check that.
It's interesting what they're doing. I'm not buying in 100%. Because I'm a traditional reader. I don't know what's going to go on in the future.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was an interesting article in the New Yorker saying just how new technology replaces old technology, and I think it was by Malcolm Gladwell, and his interesting point was that a lot of times the new technology isn't as good as the old technology in terms of the experience of the user, but it's good enough and it's more convenient, you know. So like TV, you know, watching a movie on TV isn't as good as watching a movie in the cinema, but you're in your house and you can just turn on your channel, you know. It's good enough. Everybody starts watching TV.
Convenience over quality.
Yeah, and I think that's clearly happening all across, you know, entertainment and certainly in comics. So, you know, like it or not. And I'm with you. You know?
Yeah.
I don't love comics.
Different experiences. I can't. I'm currently suffering through I have to get rid of some comic books. Digitally, that's not the case. I can keep those forever. They don't take up space.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Final question. Why the heck is it more expensive to buy your book in PDF at your website than it is on Comicology?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because you get more. I didn't include the old MuckTuck stuff in the Comicsology book.
Okay. You know what?
You get extra material.
I bought the Comicology stuff. As well, I bought both, but I've never read the Comicology version. And I already own that. I just bought it so I could keep it with the rest of myself.
Oh, God bless you. But, yeah, there is a difference, and I did it deliberately because I wanted to give you a little extra with the PDF. Comicsology didn't seem to object. Not that I told them about it, but, yeah, if you get the PDF, you get all the MuckTuck stories that I myself did. Same with the, trade paperback. They're also in the trade paperback. Okay.
Yeah, they're great. So, it's worth the extra $2. The physical copy of Spirit of Boo is available on Amazon CrateSpace.
Yes.
And yes, through your website, you can get the PDF. Or can you get the PDF through Amazon as well?
No, you got to get it from my website. I don't remember why.
It's not too much of a process. It's really easy. And your website
Really. It's hardboiledshaman.com.
Oh.
That URL was available.
Yeah, hard to imagine.
It's like somebody got it already. Yeah, hardboiledshaman.com. www.hardboiledshaman.com will get you to my website. And you can download, you know, you can get a copy there.
You started your, or one of the companies you started off at was, Fantagraphics.
Yes.
We've just lost, Kim Thompson.
Really?
Yes. He died on Wednesday, unfortunately.
Oh my God. I did not hear that.
And I was kind of hoping maybe you'd have a remembrance or something.
How did that happen?
It was lung cancer from my understanding.
Really? He wasn't a smoker as far as I know.
I don't know. I know he stepped down several months ago.
Oh.
Actively publishing.
Oh, jeez. How old was he? He must have been in his late 50s, right?
I believe so. I don't have facts in front of me, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I'll Google it. Oh my God. You're like blowing me away here. Jesus. Kim. You know, Kim was the guy I really dealt with at Fantagraphics. I mean, he was Fantagraphics to me. And, you know, my experience with Fantagraphics was, in retrospect, it was better than I thought it was at the time. because, you know, I left Fantagraphics and went to Dark Horse thinking, like, things would be way better. And then, you know, it turned out they really weren't. Not that Dark Horse wasn't a great company to work for. It was. I learned some things about, I think, the market. Kim was, you know, Kim was always just a really, you know, Kim was a very supportive person, and but he was also really a depressing person. He was funny. I mean, Kim was a really, really funny guy. And I'd call Fantagraphics and I'd say, you know, Kim, like, why is my book selling so crappy? And he'd go, because it's good. It was just like, you know, it just felt like, well, what's the point? You know, I could just like kill myself now. But he was always, you know, there would always be this, you know, this wink there. Kim was a really funny guy and he had a real sense of humor about what they were doing. And, you know, those guys single-handedly created the alternative comics market and by extension the graphic novel market. And without Fantagraphics, you know, there wouldn't be companies like Top Shelf and Drawn and Quarterly. You know, they were there, you know, way earlier than anybody else, and the Comics Journal and all that stuff. You know, they really turned the underground movement into something, you know, the most, I would say, the most vital part of comics today. And they really, you know, when I started working for them, the notion that the stuff that we were doing would occupy any place in mainstream popular culture, just that we dreamed about it, but nobody really expected it to ever happen. And I'm still not sure it's quite happened, but it certainly has happened a lot more. And I think, you know, the place of comics in society is really – they did it. I mean, they made that vision a reality. And I give them more credit than almost anybody else. And when I say them, that's Kim and Gary. And, you know, I mean, Kim was, you know, I mean, Kim, you can't really underestimate Kim's importance in what's happened with comics in the last 10 years.
No, he created during a certain era, Fantagraphics was, every book was just, it had quality to it.
Absolutely.
I love that era. Unfortunately, I dropped out of comic books for a while. So
yeah.
I'm way back now, but unfortunately, Fantagraphics didn't come back with me, and I'm sad about that, actually.
Well, the world changed, you know, and the stuff they were doing, you know, there's no place for it anymore. There's new stuff now. There's a new kind of structure, but I feel, you know, really lucky and fortunate to have participated in that. And I don't think I realized it at the time. I mean, I kind of did, but, you know, how impermanent that world was, but I did realize how exciting it was. And, you know, to have been part of that scene, that 90s alt comic scene, you know, I was like at the epicenter of that, and I hung out with all those guys, and I was one of those guys. And that was a really, really gratifying and exciting thing to be part of it, to be part of.
You were in Seattle during that time?
No, but I mean, I would go to San Diego every year. And I mean, there was a big comics contingent in Chicago. I mean, Dan Klaus lived there for a long time and we used to hang out and get, I mean, we had a big scene over there.
Oh, now I just want to ask questions. What was it like hanging out with Dan Klaus? But
it was great. We were good friends. Me, Dan, Chris Ware, Gary Lieb. Archer Pruitt, Gary Lieb, who did a book called Idiot Land, Jessica Abel. We used to get together every week in the early 90s and draw mini comics. We would do like Exquisite Corpse mini comics in this coffee shop in Wicker Park. And it was amazing.
Did any of those actually see the light of day, or were they just...
I have copies of them. Oh. Some of them have been published here and there a little bit as part of other things. You see them occasionally. Gary's got all the originals. I have Xeroxes of them. One of them was included in, I guess, Dan Klaus's book, Modern Cartoonist. A couple of them were featured in there, including one that I worked on. I was there every week, so I was in almost all of them. We would try to crack each other up, you know. And it was like going to grad school. And it was like a cross between grad school and Paris in the 20s. I mean, it was such a great thing.
Just that group there, the talent involved, because I've read a lot of those guys. And
oh, yeah.
Just to have that all happening in the same room would have been...
And, you know, we knew it, and we were also like, we were just starting out, you know? And nobody was, like, really famous yet, you know? And not that any of them really are now, but, you know, we're really all just starting out. I mean, some people were, you know, Dan's 8-Ball was doing well and Chris Ware was just starting to get attention. But we were all basically, you know, I wouldn't say we're at the same level, but you know, we were close. We were close. It was really, really exciting. I mean, it was really, really fun. You know, so we had, I mean, you know, there was, even though I wasn't in Seattle, actually, I was very much a part of, I mean, I corresponded with people. I talked to them on the phone. My sister-in-law actually lives in Seattle, so I would go out like every year or so, you know, go visit the office and, you know, go to parties and, you know, I went to parties at Pete Bagg's house. And, you know, everybody was there and, you know, I was part of it. I would see them at San Diego. We'd hang out, you know.
Alrighty. Let's bring this back into the modern era a little bit and just talk quickly about Edge City, which is your King Features syndicated strip,
yes.
Which unfortunately does not run. I can't find it anywhere in Albury in newspapers, of course, finding comic book strips in newspapers.
It is
hard.
Running in Canada. It runs in a couple cities. It runs where David Chelsea lives. Not David Chelsea. David Collier.
Okay.
You know who he is?
I know who he is. I don't know where he lives.
He lives in Ontario, and it starts with an H.
Hamilton.
Hamilton. It runs in Hamilton.
All right. I will. I have a shop here. I'll look it up. And I believe King Features has some sort of app. I tried to download it. It didn't work out too well for me.
Oh, really? Daily Inc?
Daily Inc, yeah.
Really? It should work.
I didn't want to pay for it.
Oh, well, there you go. You can see it on its website. Yeah, it runs in Philadelphia, so I see it every day, which is gratifying. Yeah. Well, you know, I always wanted to do a comic strip. That's... You know,
yeah, it makes complete sense where you look what you were doing and move it into the comic strips.
Yeah.
But one question I have, any chance of Eno and Plum taking a visit to Edge City?
Ugh. You know, I'll tell you, there's one character from Eno and Plum that actually shows up in Edge City. Eno's friend, Thay Roan, I turned into a character in Edge City, and he occasionally appears like an aging punk rocker guy. Yeah, Eno and Plum are really creatures of their era. They would be like the hardest characters to revive, I think. You know? I'd have to like change them utterly, and I mean, I'm like in my 50s now, I'd feel kind of weird writing that stuff.
You know, I'd love to see Eno and Plum in their 50s.
Yeah.
That would be...
It probably would be, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But Edge City's got its own cast of characters, and we've been doing it 11 years now, so it's been great. I love doing it. It's been like a steady income, and it's, you know, I mean... And they don't syndicate cartoonists anymore, so I feel really lucky to have gotten in the door before the door shut. That's been, you know, it's been a great thing. And you know, Edge City is kind of more about my life now, you know, because I'm just like an aging dad with like kids and living in the suburbs and everything. So it's really gratifying to me. And then there's like this whole audience that reads Edge City that has, you know, no idea that I used to do this other stuff.
Well, it's that whole gap in between your comic books and then it's hard to follow a guy who drops out for a little bit.
I know, but you know, it just, comics just wasn't happening for me. You know, comics broke my heart.
It breaks many hearts from my understanding.
Yeah, you know, and it was just like, I had two kids and it's like, you know, I just can't keep like hanging around here. All my editors left. I mean, you know, there was that whole crisis in the late 90s with Marvel and everything, and the comics industry crashed, and all my editors at DC that I was working with left, and I had nobody, you know, and I had no prospects, and you know, I couldn't go back and do like more comics that, you know, I wasn't making any money off of, and it was just like I kind of had a big career crisis, and I got syndicated right around that time, so that was it. You know,
you're living the dream. You're creating for a living. That's.
Yeah, I know. I'm happy. I mean, the thing is that now I think, you know, things have opened up quite a bit, and, you know, you don't have to just, you know, the comics industry was so insular, back then.
Oh, we're in an exciting time right now.
Yeah, and it's just everything's open up, and mainstream publishers are doing graphic novels, and there's just a lot, and there's the web, and there's just a lot more things going on and a lot more alternatives than there were. So, you know, I mean, I'd like to do more. I'd like to do more comics, whether it's Muktuk Wolf's Breath or, you know, something else. I mean, at the very least, I'd like to get – I'd really like to – you know, you asked me in your email, you know, if I was going to do CUD. I'd really like to put the CUD, the Fantagraphics CUD stuff in a trade paperback. You know, I own all that stuff now, and I have it all. So I'd really like to put – it was never reprinted.
I think it would find an audience now.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, you know,
because
at least people can find it.
I mean, people aren't just looking for superheroes anymore. There's a whole plethora of different types of comic books.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I have to scan it and make it, and it's a project, so that's, you know, maybe I should hire somebody.
Better than starting from scratch.
Maybe. But with starting from scratch, it's exciting. When you do stuff that's 20 that you did 20 years ago, it's like, oh, this stuff again? Jesus Christ. You know, that's really the trouble for me, is I'm very, you know.
I hate to backtrack, but I have to ask. Other than the obviously financial bonuses that come along with this, would you have liked to see a Jack Black Muktuk Wolf Breath movie?
I don't know. Because they were talking about, like, the guy that brought me in was actually, like, turned out to be this old fan of mine. He was like, yeah, we're going to set it in the modern era, and Jack's going to be, like, a shaman on a reservation or something. And I was like, I don't know, you know. But, you know, all things being considered, sure. Absolutely, because it would have been an incredible experience. And, hey, who knows? It might still happen. I have the rights again, so if anybody hears this podcast, I do think it would be a great movie.
I do, too. I just imagine it being a Jack Black project.
Can you? I actually think he'd be a pretty good Muktuk. You know? He's kind of that, he's got that stout, hairy thing going on. Why? Who do you imagine as Muktuk?
I can't. Adam Beach, maybe.
Adam Beach. It's like, I thought the Steve Parkhouse Muktuk was a little too lean and handsome.
Okay.
You know?
See, I read Boo. I'm still seeing that older character because that's who I was first introduced to.
Well, it's the same character.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, but in my head, I'm still seeing Steve Parkhouse.
Oh, you're still seeing the Steve Parkhouse one.
Yeah.
Because for me, the Steve Parkhouse one was like a total aberration. That's like,
Of course, you created the character, and if I was introduced to yours first, which unfortunately I didn't discover CUD until after,
yeah.
I think I'd see yours, but still reading Spirit of Boo, I'm like, this is so weird. This is definitely the same stuff, but it's all cartoony.
Yeah, that's me.
Has a place, and I love what you do, just because this one story.
No, I hear you. I mean, it's, you know, that's the way our minds work, right? You know, you saw this thing first, and you thought it was one thing, and then you discovered it was like, you know, it existed in like these other forms. You know, I mean, it's true. I draw the way I draw. You know, it's a certain kind of thing. You know, I'm in the end, I don't really like it when people draw my stuff. I like to draw it myself, you know. I'm a writer artist, so for better or for worse.
Alrighty. Do you have any plugs to lead off with?
Well, check out my book, Muktuk Wolf's Breath, Hard Boiled Shaman. Plug in other people. I don't know, you know, I've been hanging out with these Philly guys lately, And I've been really, you know, liking Box Brown stuff. Have you seen Box Brown?
No.
Oh, check him out. He does an online comic called Everything Dies, but he won an Ignatz Award, was it 2 years ago?
Everything Dies.
Yeah. you'll be hearing about him. He's a great, great, cartoonist. Let me think. I wish I had that book. I have it over here, but I don't want to like leave the podcast. Wait, Troop. If you haven't heard it, you should, could you hold on one second?
Not a problem.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
It's, Troop 142 by Mike Dawson.
Oh God, I got a reading pile here now. I love it.
Wait, I loved it. I thought it was just a fantastic book.
Troop 142.
Yeah, it's about a Boy Scout, it's about a Boy Scout camp, and he's got like all these different characters, and he really handles them well. And if you've ever spent time at a Boy Scout camp, which I haven't exactly, but I've spent time in places like that, it's like, it's pretty, you know, it'll take you back, and not necessarily in a good way. But it's a great book. It's really, really well done.
Oh, sounds right up my alley.
Very much. He was nominated for a best web comic a few years ago for the Harveys. He didn't win, so it has gotten some attention.
Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it. I will continue to recommend your work to anybody who will listen.
Thank you so much.
It's always been a pleasure, and I can't express how grateful I am for you coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. I can't express either. I really appreciate it. It's believe me, it's I appreciate it very, very much, and I'll keep you posted.
Alrighty. Thank you very much. Terry LeBan.
Okay. Thanks very much to Terry LeBan. And I think you may be back on the show someday. Chris, again, good stuff, my friend. And we'll go out with another Chris interview right at the end here. But Brett, let's cut to We Views. It's just you and me. So this should be hopefully fairly painless. What do you want to do first? Oh, by the way, Brett, we're saving you from.
Here I come to save the day.
Bad comics.
Excellent.
All right, so since there's two of us, and we are kind of like these two characters, just, you know, within our podcast world, why don't we do Batman Superman number one first?
Open up with the big one, huh?
So the question is, which one of us is Batman and which one of us is Superman?
I'm Superman, you're Batman. I mean, we all know that. That's, come on.
I'm totally fine with that.
I mean, I think that's pretty obvious. All right. This is a very interesting book. Again, it's pretty obvious. I didn't 100% know what was going on, and I didn't know if that was because of the storytelling arc or because it's that I haven't been following the Superman and Batman so much in the New 52. But from what I have read and have seen, this wasn't making 100% sense to me. But I do think it's maybe a little bit of both. I mean, there definitely is points here where they're referencing or just the characters have had changes put to them that I'm not 100% sure of. But it does show the first meeting of Batman Superman. I think this is a very interesting book. Greg Pak, his dialogue is strong. And he paces it nicely. It's a nice warm-up for what he takes over Action Comics. But really, the draw here is Jay Lee. I mean, Jay Lee is among my favorite pencilers of all time. And his work here is as good as it's ever been anywhere. He sometimes actually tends a tendency to get a little bit too heavy on the inks. This one is just beautiful drawn, but looks painted almost, beautiful coloring. And towards the end of it, Ben Oliver takes over. It's almost seamless. At first, I didn't even realize it wasn't Jay Lee, even though he has a different style. But his work was great, too. And even the covers on this, Jay Lee's cover, but even the covers they have, the variants on this, are unbelievable pieces of art. Artistically, this is a book I'm going to keep reading this. I don't know. Will they be able to keep me long term? Jay Lee doesn't just generally stick around too long for things. But, I mean, I'm back for issue two for certain.
Yeah, that was interesting because that's pretty much the first thought that I had when I opened it up and saw, or when I looked at it and saw Jay Lee's name there. And I thought, yeah, this shouldn't last very long with Jay Lee at the helm. But I'll tell you, you are absolutely correct. His art is spectacular in this. I did have to go back to look at when Oliver's art started because it was a pretty seamless transition. Like, it's very obvious when you go back and look at it, but when you're reading it, it is definitely seamless. And I would have to say that part of that is because because of Greg Pak's writing. But, yeah, like you, I was pretty well confused during the book because there was just some moments, but then there were some really good moments that I kind of got behind. And I think that, you know, it could just as easily go into an area where I don't want it to go, but I'm really hoping that it goes someplace where I, you know, with a Superman that I like and with a Batman that I like, and that the villain that they have is really cool. He seems really cool so far, so I'm hoping for the best, and I will continue.
Yeah, there's definitely a villain and a plot thread there that is opened up but not too much explored, and it's kind of intriguing. You know, I mean, I think you nailed it here. I mean, it's really about the characterization. And the characterization so far, Batman, Superman, seems right. You get that right, you can do a lot, right? And so that's what makes me feel like I was reading those characters in the right way. All right, well, Brett, let's stay with DC here. They had another number one this week.
All right, a little Lar Flees action. Now, in my reading of the Green Lantern comics, I've gone through Lar Flees, you know, and I haven't been reading for a very long time, but I've been reading the you know, Lar Flees in the Green Lantern books, and I was like, why in the hell are they giving this guy his own book? And then I get Keith Giffen, and I get J.M. DeMatteis, and I get Scott Collins, and at the end of this, I'm like, well, why the hell didn't you give me this book 6 months earlier? This is super funny, and it actually makes the character relevant to me. And overall, I thought this book was a ton of fun. It looks really good. It reads really good. And I am totally on Lar Flees.
Yeah, what a pleasant surprise, too. I mean, you're literally – this is a character I associate very strongly with Geoff Johns, so I was wondering if anybody else would really get it. And I wasn't sure when I – even when I opened it up, like I bought it. I didn't even notice it was Giffen and DeMatteis until the title screen where it gives lists the creators. It's really, really funny. You know, I'm going to say this. You might think this is a little bit weird because, I mean, this is them again back to being their funny kind of guys. They have that great chemistry together. But this actually felt to me like the tone of this felt very much like a Gru comic book.
Oh, yeah, I can totally see that.
Tone-wise.
Yeah.
And I mean that tone-wise it had that. Just the way the characters would say something, and then the other character would say something insulting him, and the character wouldn't pick it up, and just, you know. And Lar Flees reminded me a little of Gru there, greedier, but I mean, I don't know how you possibly sell a book to an outsider named Lar Flees, because they'll wonder what the hell that is, but... Like, the tone of this was like Gruen. That's a huge compliment. And I laughed out loud during this book. Really funny book. Comedy's not easy to do in a superhero world, and they nailed it on this one. I really liked it.
I love the Butler character.
He's great.
Wore me up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Lar Flees is, well, he's funny too. I mean, it's good stuff.
It is very good. Yeah.
It's the good stuff. Basically, by the way, it's Lar Flees telling his own beginnings. But you don't know because he's somewhat insane if what he's saying is true or not.
Well, he said half of it's true, but he half, won't but say which say isn't. Which is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's really good stuff. So that's kind of the concept of this one. What do you want to do next?
Well, why don't we do one of your favorite writers, Andy Diggle, and his new book from Dynamite, Uncanny.
Yeah, I was really, really looking forward to this because I'm a big fan of Andy Diggle. And, you know, I was kind of talking it up to some people here. And then I get it, and I'm opening it up, and it starts off a little weak for me. I mean, the opening dialogue, caption boxes, I guess you'd call them, as they're doing the internal dialogue, monologue for the character, was a little weak, just not how people speak. So it took me a little while to get into it. But as I started to understand this, the idea is here is this guy who's basically a con artist, kind of self-centered character, who has the ability when he touches you to, like Rogue, to absorb your memories and your abilities. But he's absorbing the memories and abilities of real people, of not of superheroes. And I hope he's the only guy I hope we don't see other superheroes. I think that's what's intriguing about it. Also, the fact that he's kind of a dick actually helps this book because he's a dick and yet I kind of like him. I think the dialogue picks up quite a bit. The art is well suited to the book, a gritty feel to it, well paced, intriguing, a little bit of a mystery. It picked up and got really, really good for me. Yeah, so as long as they don't make this to a whole superhero type world for me, I definitely will be there and be back to it.
The first half almost lost me the entire book. It was definitely, I just didn't like it at all. I thought this is really stupid. Thankfully, the second half brought it out a little bit. But for me, I think the ultimate thing is that I'm just not sure that I have enough invested in the book, even after, like, just after the first issue, to want to carry on. I don't think that Andy Diggle is bad by any stretch of the imagination. I've read some fantastic Andy Diggle, and maybe this will get to that point, but it's not there right now. And so if I remember that number two is coming out and remember to have a look at it, then I might carry on, but I might just forget, and I probably won't feel bad if I do.
Now, it's kind of one of those books I could see that could be on the shelf for somebody like you, or for me, for somebody, since I'm a fan of the writer. That's the main reason I'll go buy, not because this blew me away, though I think it did get quite good. Like I say, I like the idea that when he steals these abilities, also he has them very temporarily. So he's got to maximize the use of them.
Yeah, I don't...
It's not like he has them for a week or something,
no,
right?
I don't mind the character. I thought the character was pretty good, but I'm just not sure the book had the spark that I'm looking for.
Well, I think it'll get better and better based on the fact it got better as this went on. Maybe it's trade. Maybe it's a trade weight, Brett.
I expect it probably is.
And then recommend it to you after that. All right, well, why don't you do... hell, Brett, let's have some fun. Godzilla.
Go, go, Godzilla.
Hell, we're throwing that song on at the end of this podcast.
All right.
We're going to end this podcast after we'll have another interview with... Chris that he did here, and then we're going to throw out some Blue Oyster Cult.
All right, talking about Godzilla.
Tokyo's gotta go, 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 Godzilla. I love that song.
Well, in this case, Godzilla Rulers of Earth, which is pretty much an introduction to all sorts of the monsters. At this point with the world, they've kind of given up. They've kind of said, yep, we live with a whole bunch of monsters. So we just have to learn how to live with them. So I think it's a really cool concept, and this may finally be the Godzilla book that I look at and say, yep, I'm going to keep reading this one. It's got pretty strong art. It's got good, solid dialogue. Some of the characters I'm not 100% sold on, but really, when you have giant monsters, I'm not looking for that much more. And there was one thing that I was looking for. I was looking for Godzilla at some point to say, "Screeonk," and he did. So for me, that was a big giant check mark in the yes, please. And so overall, I think Godzilla Rulers is probably for me.
Yeah, you know what? This is a story by Chris Mowry and Matt Frank. Mowry does the writing. Frank does the art. It's a very cartoony style, so I wasn't really sure for it. But the thing about it is, while the people are cartoony, it suits the tone of the book, and the monsters look great in this cartoony style that he does it there. Like, these are just, it's great fun for these monsters. And like you say, he just sets up, basically just setting up this huge battle royal and these people who kind of have to learn to deal with it because it's not going to stop. This huge battle royal between all these characters. I mean, it's just fun. It's a book that is loose, fun, action book, and you know what? It's a book to put your brain on vacation with, and that's not a bad thing sometimes. This is a nice change of pace for me. I like this too.
Totally.
And all right, we're not disagreeing on anything.
No, we're really not. We're really not.
I doubt we will on this one either.
It's probably true. Yep. Well, now you have a book where your brain actually needs to come out of vacation and actually get back to work. This one is Greg Rucka's Lazarus.
Yes. Lazarus, published through Image and Rucker and Michael Lark. I'm going to try and get people to understand this. I'm actually going to read the opening little dialogue box here before the story starts. It says, "The world now lies divided not amongst political or geographic boundaries, but amongst financial ones. Wealth is power, and that power rests only with a handful of families. The few who provide a service for the ruling family are cared for. All others are waste. In each family, there's one person given the best they can offer, training, technology, and assets, every scientific advantage. This person has named their family Sword and Shield, their protector, their Lazarus. In the family Carlyle, the Lazarus is called Forever. This is her story." So basically, this her story is that she is, I mean, these people, these families, they're not good people, not run by good people. She's a member of that family, but she seems to be developing a conscience, and they don't want that. That doesn't seem 100% original, but it kind of is presented in an original way. It's Rucka. So best dialogue on the planet, maybe? Maybe. Michael Lark's, I'm not as big a fan as some people of Lark. I find his inks a little heavy. I think his character design is really, really solid as far as making it look good, but also completely uninspired. I think he does do a nice job rendering a full world and setting a mood. He does a great job with that, and he's really good at action scenes. There's an extended action scene in here, which he nails. So his art is good for what it's doing in this book. And Rucka has set up, once again, an intriguing, basically, concept based on these characters, because you immediately understand them and you feel for them. He manages to make you feel the emotion he wants to make you feel for the people in the book. And that's definitely a very, very strong, very, very strong opening issue.
Well, there is no question that I can tell that Rucka has a lot to unpack in this book. Like he tries to start and he gets a lot done, but I know there's still so much more. And I think that's what really intrigues me about this book, is the world that he is building is really interesting to me. The whole thing is really intriguing. And at the end of the book, there's this really fantastic article, essay, whatever you want to call it, about how he kind of came to it and how everything came together to bring it. And it was. I mean, the fact that he talked to Warren Ellis about some elements, the fact that, you know, it was Michael Lark, it was everything came from so many different places.
Well, just like looking to the creative mind of this guy, and it doesn't work the way you expect it to, but it's really, he's very, very honest about it. It's very, very intriguing.
And to me, like, if there was any part about the book that I didn't like, it was all changed by reading that at the end. Because to me, that just set everything up, and I'm just like, oh, okay, you know what? I'm going to get exactly what I want out of this book. And frankly, I trust Greg Rucka, you know, pretty highly. So overall, this is fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, one of those books that you're reading and you're going, okay, it has an ending. He said that years from now. This is going to be this. You know what? I'll say one thing. I think this, and even more so, I think Uncanny. I predict both of these to be major motion pictures.
They both have that. Like Uncanny, I thought especially had that element of like of option of getting optioned.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I say, in a good way. But yeah, I mean, this will be kind of like Walking Dead, maybe. Just something you can, because it doesn't just have to be this family. That's what's intriguing to me.
Oh, for sure. It's a big world, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
All right. What do we say? What do we want to do here? We want to do our plugs and then go out to the interviews? You want to?
No, I think that's a good idea. We can do our plugs.
All right, you got anything to plug, Brett?
All right. Well, as of this going up, this should mean that the next edition of my Access All Ages is going up on Comicosity. So I certainly would ask everybody to check that out. Otherwise, there's going to be lots more coming up, but we're certainly getting over some of the hump of the big interviews, but it's been fantastic fun with these interviews.
Yeah, just, you know what, just when we think that they're done, more might pop up. Thanks very much to Comicosity also for helping us set up some of these interviews. Of course, they are the best, and I promise to write something for them. We're coming up on a long weekend here in Canada, so I better get humping and get that done. So look for that soon, hopefully. And you can reach Brett as Brett_WeTalk on Twitter, Chris is Chris_WeTalk on Twitter. Keith is @CupperBroiderK because he wants to be different. I'm Mo_WeTalk. Brett has two T's in his name. I have no E in my name. I think that pretty much sums it up. For comics at WeTalk Podcasts, Comic Podcast Network is something out there that you can find more content with. And so we'll just throw out a mention to them again. And boy, Brett, I think we're just about OUT.
That's right. So we're going to throw to Chris talking to Jeffrey Eddy, the president of Sofa Wolf Press.
And then, Blazer Cult!
That's right. So Chris has promised us that he has an interesting story, a funny story about talking with Jeffrey Eddy. So hopefully we're going to have that one coming up next week.
And even if we don't, we got Blue Oyster Cult, BOC, singing Godzilla.
All right. Go, go, Godzilla.
Go, go, Godzilla. O-U-T.
I'm sitting down with Jeff Eddy, a president of Sofa Wolf Press. And I was prompted to contact them over a book and a Kickstarter that I'm very excited I'm supporting. It's the Kickstarter for the Digger Omnibus. Really interesting Hugo Award winning web comic book. Jeff, can you explain to me what Digger is?
Hi, Chris. Yeah, hi. Sure. So Digger is a comic about a wombat. It's a kind of Alice in Wonderland-y sort of telling of a wombat who finds herself in a strange land and is trying to find her way back home. And wombats in Ursula's universe are very pragmatic sorts of people. They don't really truck with magic. They don't have much to do with gods. They are really just, you know, down to earth, digging and doing what they can with their hands or claws, as the case may be. And so she's quite chagrined to find herself not only involved with magic, but gods and demons and myths and premonitions and all those things. So, but being the good-natured soul she is, she does the best she can, and in the process manages to impact a whole lot of people's lives and improve them along the way.
Yeah, we should mention this is a webcomic by Ursula Vernon.
Yep, correct.
And I think the thing that caught me most by surprise about this Kickstarter campaign you're running is I'm a little bit of a Kickstarter addict. I'm supporting way too many projects. I check my Twitter or my Kickstarter app about 5 times a day. And you guys got funded before I even knew you had a comic book worth funding. How quickly did you reach your goals on this?
I believe it was within the first 24 hours we had made our base funding goal. It was a surprise to everyone. We obviously had somewhat of an inkling because we had, you know, planned ahead for at least the first few stretch goals, but no one expected that we'd be hitting them quite as quickly as we did. And I really have to credit Ursula's fans. They love everything that she does. They love Digger. They love her, you know, children's book, Dragon Breath, which is published through Penguin Dial, and her other children's book, which was called Nurk, which was published through, I don't remember now offhand, but it was another mainstream publisher. So they really love her stuff. She has a whole lot of personality. She has a big following on all her blogs and all her stuff. So, yeah.
It looks like you're going to hit your top stretch goal. Have you come up with something else?
We are in the process of coming up with another one now. Ursula has just been away on her honeymoon for the last week, so was blessedly unreachable during that time. So now that she's back, we have some ideas and we're talking to her about it. I can't really reveal anything beyond that right now. But.
Okay. So she is going to have to learn to smith pickaxes.
Perhaps. Hopefully, we will get that handled by a third party so that she doesn't run the risk of injuring herself.
Why don't you just give us a brief rundown of some of the more interesting rewards you can get for supporting this Kickstarter?
Sure. We set up the Kickstarter with the idea to provide, you know, just a book for people who just wanted to sort of pre-order. But then from there it goes up to hardcover copies of the book, to signed editions and all that usual stuff. And then we engage some of, like, Ursula's friends to do things. Deb Kasiba, and I may be pronouncing that wrong, sorry Deb, who did the base for the Hugo Awards, a beautiful artist, works in stained glass, did some stained glass sun catchers, one very exclusive one for one of the high ends, and then some smaller ones. And we've got, you know, stickers and cloison pins and the pickaxes was a great fun idea. They're wombat scale, real working replica pickaxes, which we'll have engraved with Remember Tunnel 17, which was a line from the comic. And then at the highest levels, we also have Dinner with Ursula and Kevin at Worldcon, which is in San Antonio in September.
All right. Yeah, and why don't you just share with us what Sofa Wolf Press is?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so Sofa Wolf Press has been around for about 12 years now going on. We specialize in really anthropomorphic animal comics, novels, etc. We grew up in the furry fandom, so-called, but we like to think that we're a bridger. We like to bring the best of the stuff from the furry fandom out into the mainstream and bring some of the mainstream stuff into the furry fandom. So we've been doing that for quite a while. We have a range of, like, stuff from novels to artist sketchbooks and some other graphic novels. And
okay. And final question. Why publish in omnibus form? Oh, and I thought that
to make it hard to say.
Yes. Other than to make it hard to say, to stumble me up. Why do this rather than continuing as you have done with single issues? Or are you continuing the single issues?
Those who want to sort of collect them that way. The main reason was because we produced these single issues while she was working on the comic, so we could release them in an ongoing basis while she completed things. But bookstores really don't like eight of something or six of something when they can have one of something. Plus, the economies of scale mean that if you're printing one very large book, you can do it a lot cheaper than you can a lot of smaller books. So the main goal is to provide a really nice package that's attractive to more bookstores, so we can get it into better distribution out there.
All right. And final question about the Kickstarter. We are a Canadian podcast, although we have many, many American viewers. You have some special premiums for us Canadians, don't you?
Yes, we do. Regrettably, shipping being what it is for small businesses these days, it's very expensive via basically any route we can take to get things to Canada, and also to the rest of the world. And Canadians have it a little bit better off, as do Mexicans, as compared to the rest of the world. But Kickstarter only allows us to really kind of slice the onion so many ways. So we had to have sort of one ballparky shipping total for international, which includes Canada and Mexico. So we added in some extra special engagements at one of the stretch goals that we've already passed. A special pin that's going to be designed specifically for Canadians, to sort of say thank you for the shipping being maybe a hair higher than everyone else will pay, though ultimately we've subsidized the shipping at a lot of levels, so even though it seems very expensive, we'll actually be taking a hit on it.
Well, I thank you, and I encourage all our listeners to take a look at Digger, available through their Kickstarter. I think they're offering some wonderful deals, as well as at diggercomic.com, and you can read the whole thing there.
Absolutely.
Really interesting comic book. And awesome. Thanks for coming on the show, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for your time. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. No, it was fun.
I think I hear something big coming this way now. Oh, yeah. Well, tell me, who is it?
Now.